My name is Amy Ashcraft, and I'm with the Office of Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Today I'm going to be talking to you about the incidence of adverse events among Medicare beneficiaries. And this is a little bit of an unusual topic for the Inspector General. We're typically an organization that does oversight for the departments under the Department of Health and Human Services. There are 300 different programs, including Medicare and Medicaid, and we typically look at compliance issues and things like fraud, waste, and abuse. This kind of peer research is something that we don't do as frequently. So I guess the question is, why were we looking at this? And it's because there was a congressional mandate that was posed to us in the Tax Relief and Healthcare Act of 2006. We were asked to look at the incidence of NEVER events, which are a specific type of adverse events, and then to look at payment in connection with those events. Congress was very concerned that we're spending Medicare dollars to pay for mistakes that are occurring in hospitals, and then it kind of has the double whammy of being a potential cost saver for the Medicare program and also an opportunity to improve the quality of care that's given to Medicare beneficiaries. But this mandate was quite a challenge for us. No one has produced a national incidence rate since the Institute of Medicine released its groundbreaking report to Air is Human just over a decade ago. I'm sorry, the slide's a little bit fuzzy, but this is the cover of To Air is Human. And in this report, IOM, or the Institute of Medicine, extrapolated from several large studies and made national news by saying that the number of people who die from adverse events is equivalent to a jetliner going down and crashing every day. So what makes this work so challenging? Why hasn't anyone else looked at it? Well, first, NEVER events are exceptionally rare. NEVER events refers to a specific list of 28 events that were identified by the National Quality Forum as things that should never happen in a healthcare institution. NQF now calls this list the Serious Reportable Events List, and it includes things like performing wrong surgical procedures or a death resulting from a medication error. Further, experts disagree on what the definition of adverse events is. There are some disagreement on which list to use. Some experts focus on culpability or medical errors, and others focus on a wide range of issues, including patient harm. And there's also an inherent difficulty in distinguishing between what happens as a part of the patient's naturally occurring disease and what is actual harm that's occurring from the care that's provided to the patient. Additionally, events are inconsistently reported. With good reason, there are many systems, or most systems are voluntary and are focused on a specific subset of events. And hospitals are dealing with multiple reporting systems, and often the providers of care don't acknowledge what an adverse event is. They may see something that happens commonly to be a routine part of care and not a negative outcome of the care that they provided. And so this is why I included the graphic at the top of the iceberg. It really is the tip of the iceberg that most people are talking about when they talk about the research that's out there in terms of adverse events. Additionally, we faced a lot of uncertainty about the best way to identify events. We combed through research to try and figure out how to approach this topic and found that there are some people who advocate beneficiary interviews as an independent source that isn't trying to hide what happened to them. As I mentioned, there are reporting systems that are plagued with problems about not capturing adverse events, and medical review is truly the gold standard for identifying adverse events, but then you face problems with documentation limitations, and it's a very costly and time-consuming process to comb through medical records to try and identify occurrences. And then finally, we had a very limited time frame for the report. We were given 2 years to develop an expertise in this area and then produce our first findings, which is not a lot of time for such a clinical and difficult concept. So our first task was to identify a definition of adverse events, and we decided that it was important to capture all types of events, not just the extreme events that were included on the Serious Reportable Events List by the National Quality Forum. So we adopted an emphasis on patient harm, which was advocated by many of the experts that we consulted with during the course of our investigation. And harm is easier to measure than culpability. If someone is in the hospital and falls down, I can tell you that that person fell down and scraped their knee, but it's very difficult for me to tell you whether the person fell down because they the nursing staff hadn't come to their call button and the patient was climbing out of bed trying to get to the bathroom, or whether the patient had refused assistance from the hospital staff and fell down of their own accord. The next question is, when do you call something harm? Fortunately for us, the National Coordinating Council for Medication Errors Reporting and Prevention developed a harm scale several years ago, and this scale begins actually with level I and goes through level begins with level A and goes through level I, and but those first level A through D are what we call near misses. They're things where a mistake occurred, but the harm did not reach the patient. So we included in our analysis harm that actually reached the patient. And this includes the lowest level, level E, being something that requires medical intervention. And then progressively worse would be F, where the harm actually prolonged the patient's hospital stay. And then we move to G, where it resulted in permanent harm, and then life-saving intervention, and then finally, something that actually contributed to a patient's death. So we use this harm scale to identify what we would focus on in terms of adverse events. In addition to the harm that we talked about, we were very concerned about including the two most prominent lists of adverse events. As I mentioned before, NQF serious reportable events list is something that was part of our mandate and we needed to include. But we were also concerned about Medicare's new list of hospital-acquired conditions for which Medicare began not paying for or not providing additional payment for in 2008, which is right about the time that we were embarking on this work. We also separately identified temporary harm events. That was the level E in the category, or the lowest level of harm that we were including, where a medical intervention was required to treat the patient, but it didn't extend the patient's length of stay. In these cases, there's a little more variation in terms of what people agree constitutes a level E harm event and what doesn't constitute a harm event. So we thought it was important to separate them out, but we did want to include them because they are important patient safety indicators. For example, if a patient is diabetic, it's very common for them to have a hypoglycemic event. And if that event is quickly managed, if their patient is provided appropriate treatment, it's not very consequential to the patient. But if that patient does not have the appropriate treatment, then that hypoglycemic event can lead to stroke or even death. And so we included these largely as patient safety indicators. Now, before embarking on our national study, we conducted a pilot study to test our methodology. We focused on two counties in two different parts of the country that gave us a wide range of hospital sizes and some demographic variation. And we included a total of 24 hospitals. So specifically, we were looking at the care that was provided in hospitals for this study. We selected 278 Medicare patients who had been discharged from one of these hospitals during a one-week period in 2008. The analysis included a two-stage review. In the first stage, we included all patients that had been identified, 278, and we went through a series of screenings to identify the charts or the patients who were most likely to have experienced an adverse event without going to the expense and trouble of sending all of the charts to our physicians, which would be obviously exceptionally costly. So for our screening methods, we included hospital incident reports, the ARCS patient safety indicators, which is a computer program that uses hospital billing data to identify potential events. I believe there are 20 events that it can identify. We also actually called the patients and talked to them or their family members to see if anything happened during the course of their care that may have been indicative of an event. We also looked at the new present on admission indicators from the hospital billing data. These are new indicators that are included on Medicare claims, and identify for each diagnosis code whether the condition occurred prior to the person coming to the hospital or developed during the course of their care. And things that happen during the course of their care are more likely to be adverse events. Finally, we also had nurses actually look at all the records. They went through a very structured protocol that was developed by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. It's called the Global Trigger Tool. And they review medical records in about a 10 to 20 minute period for most cases and are able to quickly identify most adverse events. So we kind of threw the kitchen sink at it and said, through all of these different screening records, we thought we would capture the vast majority of charts that were suspicious for events. And then those cases went on to our full medical record review, and that was 183 cases, which were reviewed by our team of contracted physicians. We had a wide range of specialties, and actually were very fortunate to get top physicians in the field because they were interested in this particular issue. So they all had an expertise in patient safety as well. They used a standardized protocol, and then we also spent time discussing cases on weekly calls to gain consensus on difficult cases or cases that met one of our parameters that we wanted to give an additional opportunity to vet through the process. And we recorded those in, we recorded all of our decisions for, because it's, there's a lot of question about what should be considered an adverse event and when it should be considered under the particular circumstances. So we recorded those decisions in a physician guidance document that that we maintained throughout the process. Now, our analysis included included a description of incidents. And incidents is something that hospital administrators often think of in terms of the number of events per 100 patient days or the number of events per 1,000 patients. Our particular measure of incidence is the percent of beneficiaries who experienced one or more adverse events. And we found that, we found that approximately 15% of Medicare beneficiaries experienced an adverse event, and another 15% experienced a temporary harm event, which were those patient safety indicators that I mentioned. Now, that's a lot of patients, so it is important to note that that this doesn't necessarily mean that the patient was provided a poor quality of care. There are many cases where our physicians looked at the medical record and said this patient had a negative consequence from the medical care that was provided to them, but the care that was provided was actually superb, and sometimes they even called it heroic. So this includes both preventable and non-preventable events. Now, the second thing we were most concerned about was the incidence of adverse events that were on those specific lists that we were concerned about. We found that about 3.7% were included on the Medicare's hospital-acquired conditions list, and less than 1% were included on that NQF serious reportable events list. Once we identified events, we grouped them into categories, and this table includes both the adverse and temporary harm events. Medication events were the most common occurrences and accounted for almost a third of our events. They included things like allergic reactions to medications and side effects. One of the more severe but common medication events was excessive bleeding, which was generally the result of using blood thinning medication. And then hypoglycemic events and delirium were also prominent in this category. The next category was surgery and other procedures, and these are events that resulted from patients going to the hospital and receiving a surgical procedure or something similar. And this included a wide range of events such as respiratory complications and blood clots. Third is patient care events. These are things that happen during the general course of care, often related to nursing for the patient. They included things like severe pressure ulcers, patient falls with injuries, IV volume overloads, and they were an interesting category. They're pretty wide and dispersed in terms of what was included in them, but they're very significant to the patients. And then finally, Our smallest category was infections, which surprised us because there's a considerable amount of effort that goes into reducing infections. Maybe this is telling us that it paid off, but it could also be telling us that there's more work to be done in these other three categories. So immediately after the pilot study, we began working on our national study. But the Inspector General just actually signed our report yesterday, so it's going to be released on Tuesday. But this report will provide the first ever nationally representative rate of adverse events. We're unique in our position that we're able to access medical records from any hospital that accepts Medicare patients, so we have a unique opportunity to provide this information. So the methodology for our national study was very similar to our pilot study. We randomly sampled Medicare patients who were discharged during a one-month period in October of 2008. And the sample included 780 patients who were spread over more than 600 hospitals across the nation. We maintained the two-stage sampling design, but we focused on our most effective screening methods, which were the nurse review and the present on admission analysis, and then we also added a third screener, which was patients who were readmitted within 30 days, which is something that people have been very concerned about recently. We also added new elements to the analysis, which are preventability and the cost to Medicare. When we were planning the pilot study, there were a lot of people who advised us against broaching the topic of preventability. It's subjective, and it's very difficult to get a strong inter-rater reliability between reviewers. Some experts, including Don Berwick, the new head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, says that what's not preventable today may be preventable tomorrow. And I see someone knows that quote as well. So it's an interesting issue, and there are a lot of concerns about addressing that and making determinations for each adverse event about whether it was preventable. But when we released the pilot study, it became very clear that many people were misinterpreting our findings and presuming that the things that we found, that 15% of adverse events and 15% of temporary harm events, were all preventable medical errors, and that's not the case. So we thought it was important to provide context to add that component and make it very clear what was preventable and what was not preventable. But to do that, we had to forge new ground in terms of how to design a study that would have similar assessments for preventability and make it, we wanted to make it very transparent so that people could understand how we came to our conclusions. And for this, we had to provide a definition of preventability. So a preventable event is one in which harm could have been avoided through improved assessment or alternative actions. And a non-preventable event is one where harm could have been avoided given the complexity of the patient's condition or care required. So for example, we had two patients in our study that had dural tears from surgery. This is a condition where the surgeon cuts a membrane and spinal fluid leaks out. It's very dangerous, and we determined that one of those cases was preventable and one of them was not. The preventable case was one where the patient had only had that surgery first. They were a prime candidate for the surgery, and there weren't any special unique circumstances for that patient. For the other patient, they'd had a series of back surgeries and had a lot of scar tissue. The physicians had noted that it was a very difficult surgery in terms of navigating their way through the body, and our physicians called that case not preventable. So we also had to go beyond just having definitions. We had to have a thought process that would allow them to come to similar conclusions. So before we began, we created this algorithm or a decision tree to help them walk through the decision of what would be preventable or not preventable. We asked them questions like, were you able to identify a particular error? Was the event something that could have been anticipated? Were proper precautions taken? And how frequent was the event? This led them to a basic conclusion about whether the case was preventable or not preventable. But then we also asked them to provide a rationale. This included things for preventable, like medical errors, substandard treatment, and inadequate monitoring, Non-preventable events might be things like the proper procedures had not been followed or the patient was highly susceptible to that particular event. So if the rationales did not build a case for the preventability decision that had been made, then that made us suspicious that they hadn't come to the right conclusion. So any case where there was a question, either by the physicians or by us, about whether the response was appropriate, we took to our consensus calls, and the physicians discussed it extensively during those weekly calls. And they were some of the most interesting calls that we had. It's actually a very engaging area to think about how do you make those decisions. The next thing we wanted to look at or included in our national study was the actual cost to Medicare. Our primary interest was the direct cost to Medicare. Through those hospital payments, it was the inpatient prospective payment system. But clearly these aren't the only cost to Medicare. Our analysis only captured increased claim reimbursements and then a subset of subsequent hospital readmissions. But you can see that there are other costs to Medicare in terms of follow-up to physicians, medication, and potentially for rehabilitation services. And then the hospital experiences costs that are not reimbursed by Medicare, and there are additional costs to the patient. And very notably, in my opinion, is the long-term consequences to patients of a declining health status that may have been exacerbated by the adverse event that they experienced. So the next question is, how do we determine cost? It's not an easy thing to do in most regards. We focused on how the cost played through the inpatient prospective payment system. So the inpatient prospective payment system is based on MSDRGs, or Medicare Severity Diagnosis Related Groups, in which the patient's set of conditions or the diagnosis codes that are included on their claim are grouped into one of, I think there are about 700 DRGs, or diagnosis-related groups, and that relates directly to payment. The things that generally can affect the DRG are the patient's principal diagnosis code, which is the reason that they entered the hospital, or their procedure code, such as a surgery. And then there are CCs and MCCs. These are complications or comorbidities, or major complications or comorbidities. And these can elevate the level of DRG in certain circumstances. So within this system, we took claims as they had initially been submitted to Medicare, and then we had a coder look at them and pull out any codes that were related to the adverse event. Then we repriced the claims and then attributed differences between those cost estimates as being the cost to Medicare's inpatient prospective payment system. Now, as I mentioned, I can't give you the actual findings from the national study yet, but they will be out on Tuesday, and you can find them on the web at oig.hhs.gov. And if you want that for a minute more. So what are the takeaways from our presentation today? First, that patient harm as a result of Medicare is common in the Medicare population. It's something that we're all dealing with. If you have an elderly relative who has been in the hospital, then you may have experienced something, and you may have not even have realized that it was an adverse event or that in some cases, it could have been prevented. There are current methods to measure adverse events, but they're not readily available for widespread use. They're often difficult to employ, and there's not terribly a lot of research about how effective they are at finding events. Preventability is an important component in understanding adverse events. This is something where we made a pretty strong case that we thought preventability is something that has to be pushed forward, but it's a very debatable conclusion that we've drawn, and we encourage people that are doing this kind of research to build on the work that we've done. We don't necessarily think that the way that we determine preventability is the only way to do it, or necessarily even the best way to do it, but we think that we need to start building that foundation over time. And then finally, to reduce the national cost of medical care, providers and payers must improve patient safety. So that's it.
Any questions for her?
Tuesday, we really thought they were going to be out, and we've had a lot of interest in the administration and by Congress, so we've been doing a lot of briefings lately trying to get them up to speed before we release it to the public.
I'm sorry, who are you associated with?
OIG.
Yeah, the Office of Inspector General.
Okay. Where did the nurses come from that you used to do the screening?
We contracted through FMAS, and we actually had, through our networks, when we started doing this work, we interviewed over 80 experts in the field and developed some strong relationships with, particularly with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and with individuals in ARC and other areas. And so most of our nurses and our physicians came through as referrals through that network. We were quite fortunate in that regard because we really wanted to find people who were experts. We had a vice president of patient safety for a major hospital network was one of our physicians, and he brought in some of his nursing staff that he knew were experts at using the global trigger tool. And then through other networks, we did similar things.
So were they the physicians chosen because of their patient safety background or because of their areas of expertise, clinical areas of expertise?
A little bit of both. The clinical areas of expertise were we had an infectious disease. We wanted to have some variety. So we had an infectious disease specialist. We had a cardiologist. We had an orthopedic surgeon. We had an intensivist. And we had an internal medicine doctor. So that was our number one criteria. Well, in the first, it was really not really a choice. It was we had to have multiple specialties to cover the range of services that we would be facing. And then we also wanted them to have some background in patient safety.
So you didn't have a general surgeon?
We had the orthopedic surgeon who covered the surgery cases. And sometimes we did, our physicians used their networks and went and asked questions to other people that they knew. No, we didn't have a general surgeon, but we did, whenever there were cases, you know, I think the biggest thing there was how much blood loss is too much blood loss to be, what's normal and what's an adverse event. And there were definitely cases, with that issue in particular, where we did have them go talk to other experts that they knew.
Let me ask you a question. I'm an epidemiologist, and just wondering how are the results of this large scale evaluation is going to be. In the first sample stop, the pilot that you did, you presented the results in terms of percentages and stuff, right?
We presented the results in stages.
In percentages.
Yes.
Yeah. See, in EPI, percentages really are really not a measure of risk.
Well, in the national study, we include an appendix, and it's not really for the epidemiologist. It's really more for the hospital administrator that includes the metrics that they more commonly use, which I said are the number of events per 100 patients or
rates.
Per 100 patient
is,
days.
Yeah, rates is more applicable, and that's a measure of, of risk as opposed to...
And our primary audience, you know, we did consider that quite a bit. Our primary audience is policymakers. It's administrators, the people who run Medicare and Medicaid that can make a difference in how hospital administrators approach patient safety. So we have to make it very user-friendly and keep it in layman's terms. So we actually say, you know, one in... We use that in the national report, so I'm not going to say the other number, but we have a number of ways that we present the information, but we want to keep it very tangible, but still we provide a ton of detail in the national report. We list out every single adverse event and whether we called it preventable and what level of harm we assigned to it, because we wanted to make our results very transparent and for them to be useful for anyone else that's doing research in this field.
Thank you so much.